now at McDonald's, a McDouble is only $2.50. So you can get your gym gains on or just get lunch for only $2.50. Get more value on the under $3 menu.
Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher for delivery.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Welcome to the Divergent Files podcast.
Do you ever have one of those moments where your kid says something and for just a split second, you know that sentence didn't come from your house? Well, that's where this story starts. A quiet kitchen, dinner plates cooling. A parent wipes their hands on a dish towel and asks the kind of harmless question you're supposed to ask after your kid comes home from college. So, how's school going? And the kid looks up, but the person answering isn't your kid. The voice is theirs, sure, but the worldview, the tone, the weird prepackaged moral certainty, well, that came from somewhere else. They talk about your country like it's a crime scene. They talk about capitalism like it personally keyed their car. They talk about decolonizing the dinner table, which is impressive because last semester, they couldn't even decolonize their laundry basket. And they say it all with that new expression, the one where they're not thinking, they're performing. Like they're reciting lines from a seminar they didn't even enjoy, but now can't turn off. And you're standing there thinking, when did my child switch countries without leaving the kitchen? Because this isn't the kid you raised. This is the kid the campus processed. Their voice has the cadence of a professor who hasn't smiled since 1994. Their opinions are suspiciously identical to the group chat they joined during orientation. Their certainty is way too strong for someone who still can't cook rice. You can feel it. A worldview has been installed. And when you ask a gentle question, not a challenge, just a question, you watch their eyes flash in that strange new way. Defensive, loaded. Like questioning the idea is questioning their identity. And that didn't come from home. That didn't come from you. That came from an institution that doesn't just educate, it imprints. And here's the cliffhanger nobody wants to say out loud. The classroom didn't change your kid. The campus machine did. And tonight, we're opening it.
If this is your first time here, welcome. If you've been here before, I appreciate you coming back. I'm Ralph, Marine Corps veteran, filmmaker, and the creator of Divergent Files. Enjoy, and let's begin.
You know what's funny? Every time I touch a topic like this, someone in the comments is ready to slap a team jersey on me. So before some keyboard warrior jumps into the comments with, "Ah, so you're anti this. Oh, so you're secretly pro that." No, I'm not red, I'm not blue. I'm not whatever color cable news is trying to churn my brain into. I'm something else, somewhere outside the stadium, throwing rocks at both sides and checking the receipts while everyone's busy chanting slogans. I don't care where the truth sits on the political compass. I don't chase ideology. I chase receipts and truth. If the truth leads left, we go left. If it veers right, buckle up, we're going right. I'm an equal opportunity truth-seeking assassin. If it's real, it's in. If it's propaganda, it gets torched. Simple rules. Now, with that out of the way, here's the ugly little secret no one in higher education wants whispered near a microphone. You can predict a graduate's politics by their major. Not because kids today are more sensitive, and not because TikTok turned everyone into a poet activist with anxiety. It's because the university is built, engineered, to produce one specific worldview. A chemistry major and a sociology major don't just come out with different skill sets. They come out speaking like they grew up in a different country. One speaks in equations, the other speaks in manifestos. And it's not an accident. It's not organic, it's architecture. You see, people love pretending universities are these beautiful intellectual gardens where ideas bloom freely and professors wander around barefoot whispering about Plato. Yeah, no. Universities are factories with a personality test at the door. If you walk in believing in hierarchy, tradition, free markets, or God forbid, personal responsibility, the system doesn't debate you, it corrects you, like a bouncer with tenure. And if you walk in already leaning left, congratulations, you've just stepped into an all-inclusive ideological resort where every class validates your beliefs, every professor affirms your instincts, and every group project becomes therapy with footnotes. Here's the part people miss. Professors aren't mostly progressive by coincidence. They're progressive because the hiring pipeline demands it. Peer review demands it. Funding demands it. Tenure committees demand it. Student evaluation culture demands it. And entire departments, especially the ones that shape future teachers, journalists, activists, and curriculum writers, openly run ideological litmus tests without ever calling them that. So where do you think the phrase unfit for departmental culture came from? It's not about competence, it's about alignment. Nobody says it out loud, but universities recruit one worldview and quietly starve every competing worldview out of existence. It doesn't matter what the building is called. Women's studies, post-colonial studies, social work, education, critical pedagogy, even some branches of psychology and English. The operating system is the same. Power analysis, oppression models, identity as destiny, capitalism as original sin. America as a moral crime scene in need of constant purification. And the kids walk out believing they discovered these ideas themselves. No. These ideas were waiting for them like pre-installed apps. Just click agree. Because here's the part nobody sees. Universities don't tilt left because of ideology. They tilt left because of incentives. Because the infrastructure rewards conformity to one side and punishes everyone else. This isn't ideology. This is infrastructure. And once you see the layout of the machine, you realize the campus doesn't lean left. It's welded that way. You ever notice how a freshman walks onto campus like a normal human being? And by Thanksgiving, they talk like they've been living in a cult with Wi-Fi? That isn't because they discovered the secrets of the universe in Sociology 101. It's because the campus environment itself is a belief-shaping machine, a moral greenhouse that grows one kind of plant and quietly strangles everything else. Let's start with a part everyone pretends is innocent. Freshman orientation. Orientation isn't about showing you where the library is. It's onboarding, corporate-style, ideological onboarding with icebreakers. Day one, your kid is told what the community values are, which is code for here's the list of acceptable opinions, and here's what qualifies you as a good person, and here's how fast you'll be socially executed if you step outside the rails. Resident advisors? They're not just the people who tell you to keep the noise down. They're the moral hall monitors of the entire ecosystem. Your average RA is 19, terrified of conflict, and somehow responsible for enforcing a behavioral code with the moral confidence of a Vatican envoy. One wrong joke, and that's it. Report filed, sensitivity training assigned, your name sent to the conduct office like you're a war criminal. Students learn fast. You don't speak your mind, you speak the script. Say the right buzzwords, you get nods. Say the wrong ones, you get silence, then emails. That's how self-policing starts. Not because anyone is thinking deeply, but because nobody wants to die socially. And the social pressure? Oh, it's brutal. College is the one place where being alone feels like death. Kids will reshape their entire belief system just to avoid eating lunch by themselves. Want to see the real power structure on a campus? Check who's afraid of who. Administrators are afraid of activists. Professors are afraid of students. Students are afraid of each other. Everyone is afraid of the bias response team, a squad whose literal job is to investigate feelings. I'm not joking. You can file a report because someone looked stressed while discussing a sensitive topic. That's an official incident. And once that machinery exists, once the conduct office, bias teams, safe space coordinators, and DEI compliance committees are in the bloodstream, you don't need persuasion. You just need silence. The fear does the rest. Activism becomes currency. The more radical your stance, the safer you are. You can climb the entire social ladder just by outraging the next person. Original thought becomes dangerous. Nuance becomes forbidden. And saying, "I'm not sure," gets you treated like you leaked state secrets. So kids learn the rules. Don't ask questions. Signal morality. Stay on script. Get the A. Be liked. Survive. And by the time they sit in a classroom, the shaping is already done. The professor doesn't have to indoctrinate anyone. The environment did it for them. All the professor has to do is reward the correct opinions with grades, nods, and the occasional excellent point. The kids will do the rest. They'll enforce the worldview on themselves. And here's the part that should keep every parent up at night. Kids don't convert because they read Marx. They convert because they don't want to be alone. And once a belief is tied to belonging, good luck getting it out. If you've ever wondered why every professor your kid encounters seems to be reading from the same cosmic script, anti-capitalism, anti-America, the whole Greatest Hits album, here's the punchline. They're not clones, they're the survivors. Because higher education doesn't produce a diversity of thought. It produces a filtered product, the handful of people who made it through an ideological gauntlet designed to kill anything that doesn't lean hard left. Let's talk about the PhD pipeline, the place where dreams go to die and debt goes to multiply. People imagine doctoral programs as these noble quests for knowledge, but in reality, they're more like ritual hazing conducted by people who haven't touched grass since the Bush administration. Your advisor, one human being, controls your entire fate. They decide whether your dissertation topic is valid, whether your work is aligned with contemporary scholarship, and whether you're a good fit for the department. Translation, if your worldview doesn't match theirs, congratulations, you just academically euthanized yourself. And even if you survive that stage, next comes peer review, which sounds scientific until you realize it often means, do your conclusions properly flatter the worldview of the anonymous gatekeepers? Write a paper about how America is structurally wicked? Acceptable. Write a critique of socialism's failures? Good luck. The reviewers will make sure you're rewriting that paper until the sun burns out. And then there's tenure, the mythical golden ticket. To get tenure, you have to please a committee of people who built their careers on activism, outrage, deconstruction, and niche theory. If your work questions any of that, if your research suggests markets sometimes work, or America is not a comic book villain, you will never see a tenure package. Not because you're wrong, but because you're inconvenient. The safest career path in the university system isn't brilliance, it's obedience, wrapped in just enough jargon to look rebellious. That's why whole departments now produce scholarships that sounds like it was generated by a bot trained on a Tumblr post and French philosophy. This isn't radical professors converting your kids. This is the pipeline doing exactly what it was built to do. Filter out anyone who doesn't fit the blueprint. You're not seeing radical professors. You're seeing the only professors the system allows to exist. If you want to know why universities sound like the comment section of a revolutionary pamphlet, don't look at the professors first. Look at the checkbooks. because nothing in higher education moves without money. Not ideology, not curriculum, not activism. And here's the part nobody on campus ever wants to admit. Campuses don't tilt left because of ideas. They tilt left because that's where the money flows. Let's start with the foundations, the holy trinity of elite benevolence: Ford, Mellon, MacArthur, Soros, Open Society, Hewlett, and a dozen others with logos that scream, "We help the world," while their grant lists scream, "We fund the worldview." These foundations pour billions into the humanities pipeline every year. Not millions, billions. And what do they fund? Not nuance, not balanced history, not intellectual diversity. They fund activism, activist scholarship, activist research, activist positions, activist conferences and fellowships. You know what gets unlimited funding? Oppression studies, power studies, post-colonial studies, anti-capitalist research, anti-Western theory, racialized identity programs, queer Marxist analysis of 18th century maritime labor. I wish I were making that up, but I'm not. If it frames the West as a supervillain and every other culture as a soft, glowing victim, it's getting a check. Meanwhile, STEM departments, the ones that actually produce jobs, inventions, vaccines, rockets, electricity, the things that keep TikTok running, get starved unless they slap a DEI sticker on the grant proposal. You want money for engineering? You better mention equity. You want a biology grant approved? You better include historically marginalized microbial perspectives, or whatever new phrase buys your survival for another semester. And here's the cosmic joke. The donors funding these ideological fever dreams, they don't live under any of this. They don't send their kids into the belief systems they bankroll. They don't live in communities shaped by the theories they amplify. Oh no, they live in gated estates, sipping imported water from a glass shaped like old money. They bankrolled a worldview they would never let within a mile of their own children. But why do they do it? Well, because activist scholarship is predictable, because it flatters elites by painting them as benevolent saviors of the oppressed, and because funding left-leaning ideology buys them political goodwill at virtually zero personal cost. Meanwhile, international money pours into American university like it's a hobby. The Qatar Foundation alone has funneled billions into US campuses, especially programs tied to Middle Eastern politics. China's Confucius Institutes ran cultural exchange programs that looked suspiciously like soft power recruitment. Saudi and Gulf donors sponsor entire academic centers that magically produce scholarship attacking the West while politely ignoring authoritarian regimes abroad. If the money shapes the worldview, and the worldview shapes the scholarship, and the scholarship shapes your kid, then who the heck exactly is shaping your kid? Because let's not kid ourselves. Ideas don't spread because they're smart. They spread because they're funded. Campuses don't lean left because the faculty won a debate. They lean left because someone paid for the floor to tilt. And until you follow the money, you'll never see the hands steering the ideology. That's the trapdoor no one looks for. Campuses don't lean left because of ideas. They lean left because that's where the money flows. Do you ever watch a campus protest explode overnight and think, wow, these kids got organized real fast? Yeah, no they didn't. Grassroots doesn't mobilize with matching signs, professional-grade chants, pre-written statements, media kits, and a legal defense fund that magically appears by breakfast. That's not spontaneity. That's logistics. Campus activism today runs like a Fortune 500 company, except the interns don't realize they're employees. Let's start with the student groups. You think these groups are fueled by passion and late-night pizza and a collective hatred of capitalism? Nope. Try again. Many of the loudest groups get money from NGOs, non-governmental organizations, that have endowments bigger than small nations. You've got Open Society funding, justice initiatives. You've got Tides Foundation bankrolling youth mobilization. You've got international NGOs pumping money into campus chapters with interests that have nothing to do with education and everything to do with influence. Those student-led movements? Yeah, they're student-directed. Maybe. Student-inspired? Rarely. Student-funded? Not a chance. And hovering above them like ideological air traffic control are activist faculty. These professors don't just support student protests. They train organizers. They run workshops on disrupting events. They send reading lists full of 1960s protest manuals that smell like tear gas and Xerox toner. They even show kids how to handle press interviews, because nothing says organic uprising like media coaching. And here's the part most parents don't believe until they see the syllabus with their own eyes. Some humanities majors require activism, not recommend, require it. Missing a protest can tank your grade. Staying silent during an action can get you labeled as complicit. Your kid can literally earn course credit for chanting in a quad, blocking a building entrance, or screaming at someone holding a different opinion. Oh, and the anti-capitalism movements that pop up like mushrooms after rain? The ones railing against corporations? They're often funded by corporate-backed NGOs. Yes, capitalism is funding anti-capitalism, because nothing is more profitable than chaos that doesn't touch your portfolio. Universities play along because it's cheaper to appease activists than challenge them. Administrators would rather let a mob occupy a building than risk someone calling them insensitive on social media. So, what looks like revolution is just a schedule. Every movement has a treasurer, a communications team, a faculty advisor, a copy-pasted manifesto, a protest plan that predates every student holding a sign. This isn't rebellion. This is payroll. This is career training disguised as moral courage. Kids graduate with resumes full of organizing experience and community action leadership, then wonder why they can't get hired at anywhere except nonprofits that burn through donations faster than a bonfire made of grant proposals. And the funniest part? Activists who scream resistance are clocking more structured hours than the managers they claim to hate. The revolution isn't grassroots, it's just payroll. You ever notice how every syllabus, no matter the department, no matter the professor, no matter the year, always leans in the exact same direction? Well, it's not telepathy, it's architecture. Because professors don't write the worldview, committees do. And committees are where ideas go to get disinfected, declawed, and dipped in the house ideology like chicken nuggets in battery acid. Let's pull the curtain back a bit. The average professor doesn't walk into class with total freedom. They walk in with a leash, politely labeled curriculum guidelines. But those guidelines weren't written by a room full of balanced scholars. They were written by committees stacked with the same people who think intellectual diversity means having two activists with slightly different hair dye. Curriculum committees are ideologically homogeneous by design. Well, why? Because anyone who doesn't fit the culture never makes it onto the committee in the first place. The filter happens long before the meeting even starts. So, now you've got a system where every major, literally every major, has required theory classes. Engineering majors taking oppression theory. Business majors taking identity frameworks. Art majors taking political deconstruction. And history majors taking, well, whatever's left after everything gets reframed into a morality play about America as the villain and everyone else as collateral damage. But the real enforcers aren't the committees. They're the DEI offices. These bureaucracies are the final bosses of curriculum approval. Every new course proposal gets run through a DEI rubric so rigid it makes building codes look whimsical. Do you want to teach a class on the American Revolution? Great, but you'd better center it on marginalized perspectives and oppression narratives, or your proposal gets yeeted back into the administrative void like it insulted someone's preferred pronouns. You want to assign a book that wasn't written in the last 10 years? Well, you better justify why you're elevating canonical voices at the expense of contemporary justice frameworks. Do you want to use primary sources? Good luck. Primary sources don't have the proper ideological metadata. They contain nuance. They contain complexity. They contain human contradictions. And contradictions confuse the machine. So, what do textbook committees do? That's easy. They replace primary sources with curated commentary written by textbook authors selected for their political reliability. Why assign Frederick Douglass when you can assign a modern academic who explains what Douglass should have meant? Why let students read original U.S. history when you can give them a pre-interpreted, DEI-approved narrative that turns the entire country into a gothic tragedy with no heroes and no hope? And if you think I'm exaggerating, compare syllabus from 1995 to today. Back then, you got books, documents, lectures, debate. Today, you get theory, reflection journal, theory, group discussion, theory, and an article that treats your country like it personally keyed the professor's car. None of this requires the professor to be radical. Most professors aren't. Most just want to teach, but the machine forces their hand. Because even if a professor wanted to design a balanced class, they can't. Their proposal would get vetoed by the committee, the DEI office, the department chair, student evaluations, the activist faculty, the risk-averse administrators, and the invisible ideological gatekeepers guarding the budget. By the time a syllabus reaches your kid, it's been through so many ideological rinse cycles, it comes out smoother than a press release. And the punchline? It doesn't matter who teaches the class. You swap out the professor, the course stays the same. Swap out the department, the worldview stays the same. Swap out the entire campus, the ideology still leaks through the vents. Because in modern academia, professors don't write the worldview. Committees do. And committees do not teach your kid. They program them. You ever notice something weird? Kids don't come home hating America because they read one spicy Tumblr thread, or because they watched three documentaries on Netflix. No, this worldview is older than your parents. It's older than your grandparents, and it didn't start online. It started back in Europe, in a lecture hall, with a group of people who looked at the entire Western world and said, burn it down, but let's make the students do it. And then, God bless visas, they moved to America. So let's go to the root system. Long before TikTok, before campus protests, before DEI offices with budgets that could fund a small navy, there was the Institute for Social Research, the Frankfurt School, a Marxist think tank born in Germany, staffed by brilliant men who all shared the same unshakable belief. Western civilization is the disease, and critical theory is the cure. Not critical thinking, which teaches you how to analyze, but critical theory, the worldview where capitalism equals oppression, religion equals manipulation, and tradition equals control. Nationalism equals proto-fascism, and disagreement equals false consciousness. It wasn't analysis, it was a demolition manual. Then Hitler rose, the Institute fled, and where did they land? Columbia, Berkeley. In other words, the exact campuses whose fingerprints now show up in your kids' essays, group chats, and emotional vocabulary. They didn't sneak in. They were welcomed, funded, given offices, journals, and graduate students to mold like ideological Plato. And from those offices, they rebuilt Western thought from the inside out, one PhD candidate at a time. But that was only the first route. The second route came from the fallout of Vietnam. If the Frankfurt School wrote the software, Vietnam installed the emotional expansion pack. The 1970s university system was packed with faculty who had watched the nation unravel on TV. Napalm, draft cards, dead kids, lies from politicians, chaos, fear, shame, and somewhere in that emotional wreckage, a lot of professors concluded, America isn't misguided, America is malignant. Suddenly, patriotism looked like propaganda. Soldiers looked like victims. Capitalism looked like imperialism. And criticism felt like righteousness. This wasn't scholarship. It was trauma therapy disguised as a seminar. And those professors? They didn't retire quietly. They got tenure, lifetime seats, permanent influence. The bitterness didn't fade, it fossilized. Then came the third route, revolutionary literature. Che, Fanon, Mao. Nothing spreads on campus like a good aesthetic, and revolutionary chic had the aesthetic. Che Guevara's face hit dorm walls faster than ramen noodles. Mao's little red book slipped into reading lists. Fanon turned every classroom into a moral arena where the teacher is the oppressor and the student is the oppressed. Rebellion is self-actualization, and burning the system is liberation. It wasn't subtle. It wasn't balanced. It wasn't nuanced. And students ate it like free popcorn because it made them feel morally advanced without having achieved anything. Perfect for people who still need a syllabus to take out the trash. So what you're seeing now isn't a spontaneous youth uprising. No way. It's a 100-year-old worldview finally reaching critical mass. Put the roots together. Frankfurt anti-capitalism. Post-Vietnam anti-American guilt. Maoist revolutionary romance. Post-colonial resentment. And mix them all in with a tenured department with no ideological competition. What do you get? A worldview where America is always guilty, the West is always oppressive, capitalism is always corrupt, tradition is always suspect, students are always liberators, burning the system is always virtuous, gratitude is always naive, nuance is always betrayal, and your kid didn't invent that worldview, they walked right into it. It was already waiting for them in the reading lists, the committees, the office hours, the donors, the journals, the seminars, and the faculty who inherited a century-old ideology and mistook it for enlightenment. Your kid didn't create anti-Americanism. They inherited it. The roots were planted long before they were born. Here's the part nobody wants to admit, because once you say it out loud, you can't unsee it. Campuses aren't the end of the pipeline. They're the start of it. Everything your kid absorbs in those 4 years doesn't stay in a dorm room. It trickles into every institution you rely on without you even realizing the source. Because graduates don't vanish into the wind. They get jobs. And here's the punchline. They keep getting them in the same sectors. That journalism degree? Congratulations. That worldview now runs the newsroom. You ever wonder why every headline sounds like it was written by the same person who just stormed out of a sociology seminar? Well, because they were. Your kid's campus ideology just got a byline. And the HR major? Oh, that one's fun. They walk straight into corporate America with a clipboard full of inclusive excellence frameworks. And somehow, every workplace policy becomes a rerun of the freshman dorm meeting you didn't attend. Suddenly, you need permission slips to say, good job. The communications major? Perfect candidate for a content moderation job at a tech company. Which means the same worldview that polices speech in classrooms now polices speech in platforms. And if you think they grew out of that instinct on graduation day, I have news for you. It got worse when someone handed them a dashboard with a delete button. And then there are the education majors, the ones who become teachers. And because they were trained by professors, trained by committees, trained by foundations, and trained by ideologues, the campus worldview doesn't just survive, it replicates. Your kid isn't inheriting a worldview. It's being reapplied to them, one generation at a time. But The real final boss? The public policy graduates. They don't become activists. They become the people who write the rules activists pretend to protest. They walk into think tanks, legislative offices, nonprofits, lobbying firms, public interest organizations, in every corner of bureaucracy where language gets turned into law. And what do they bring with them? Well, the same worldview that told them America is structurally wicked. Capitalism is exploitation. Disagreement is violence. And anyone who questions the moral purity of the movement is one meme away from being exiled. This is how it spreads. Not through elections, through appointments, through hiring, through HR guidelines, platform policies, curriculum frameworks, newsrooms, agencies, and of course, nonprofits. The downstream effect isn't a coincidence. It's a replication strategy. Because once a campus becomes the place where a worldview is purified and enforced, every graduate becomes a walking distribution node, carrying the software update into the real world. They don't think they're spreading ideology. They think they're spreading best practices, modern ethics, correct thinking. And since nobody wants to get fired and nobody wants to be the office dinosaur, the ideology wins through social survival before it ever wins through argument. By the time you notice that the national tone feels off, that the country sounds less like the place you grew up in and more like a group project run by the least stable student, it's too late. Campus culture already left the building years ago. So here's the trapdoor. You don't change society by winning elections. You change it by winning campuses. Because the people who shape tomorrow aren't sitting in Congress. They're sitting in lecture halls. And the worldview they absorb there doesn't stay put. It comes home with them. It walks into institutions with them. It becomes policy with them. It becomes reality with them. That's the loop. And it's already running. Okay, so let's slow this one down for a second. Not to go soft, but to go precise. Because right about now, some of you are thinking, okay, so everything's poisoned, cool. What the hell am I supposed to do with that? And are you just bashing college because it's trendy? So let's clear the air. I don't care if the rot is coming from the left, the right, the center, or a trapdoor under the faculty lounge. If it's lying to kids, I'm coming for it. This isn't about attacking education. Real education is sacred. A good teacher is a miracle in human form. And there are professors out there doing heroic work in a system that's actively trying to neuter them. This isn't all professors are evil. Some of them are just tired. Some are trapped. Some of them are the only thing standing between your kid and total intellectual capture. And it's not all students are drones either. Plenty of kids smell the bullshit. They feel the pressure. They play the game to get the grade, then go back to thinking for themselves when they're off the clock. So this episode isn't a tantrum. It's a diagnostic. Who built the pipeline? Who funds the ideology? Who writes the rubrics? Who gets filtered out before they can say, maybe the world is a little more complicated than all this? This isn't about joining a side either. It's about asking a simple, radioactive question. If the system is neutral, simple, prove it. If it's not, well, let's talk about why. Now, the part no one ever wants to touch, what can you actually do about all this? Because I know some of you are parents watching this with a knot in your stomach thinking, my kid's 18, the acceptance letters already came. Is this just inevitable? Well, no, it's not. But you can't sleepwalk this either. First thing, stop sending kids into this machine naive. Have the conversation before the campus does. Not a lecture, not a rant, a kid who doesn't want to hear that. Just, hey, listen, you're going to hear big words. You're going to be told that certain opinions make you a good person and others make you a monster. You don't owe anyone your worldview in exchange for a grade. Play the game if you have to, but don't ever forget you're playing a game. Teach them the difference between learning about an idea and being expected to confess it. Second, vet the school like you'd vet a babysitter. Don't get hypnotized by the brochure and the shiny drone footage over the quad. Go look up what required courses look like. Check the core curriculum. See how many classes are how to think versus what to feel. If every path leads through the same ideological checkpoint, believe what they're telling you. Third, remember, college is not the only doorway to a meaningful life. I know that's heresy in modern America, but it's true. Trade schools exist. Apprenticeships exist. Community colleges exist. Gap years where a kid works a real job and sees the world before letting someone rewrite their brain for 40 grand a year, those exist too. Fourth, build an immune system at home. You don't have to match every book they're assigned with a counterbook. Just build a house where questions are allowed, where disagreement is normal, where I don't know yet is respectable answer. If the campus teaches them that disagreement is violence, then your home has to teach them that disagreement is how grown-ups figure things out. Fifth, support the good ones. If your kid finds a professor who actually encourages open thought, who doesn't punish them for questioning, tell them to latch on and never let go. Take every class that person offers. Those are the people quietly resisting the machine from the inside. And finally, stop pretending this is someone else's problem. The graduates from these places don't just run newsrooms in HR. They become the people who decide what your kid reads in third grade, what shows up in your feed, what words get labeled unsafe, what history gets memory hold because it doesn't fit the script. So no, the trajectory is not a foregone conclusion, but it will be if everyone shrugs it and says, that's just how college is now. You don't have to burn it down. You don't have to join a side. You just have to see the design, tell the truth about it, and refuse to hand your kid's mind over without terms. Because if the system really is neutral, it shouldn't be afraid of questions. It shouldn't need filters. And if it does, then the problem is not your kid. It's the machine they're walking into. Here's the quiet truth nobody says out loud. Most parents don't want to win a culture war. They just want their kid back. Not the version that comes home quoting a professor like a human bumper sticker. Not the version walking on emotional eggshells because someone might get offended. Not the version who learned how to hide parts of themselves just to survive a classroom. They want the kid who thinks, who questions, who laughs too loud, who asks dangerous, brilliant questions at the dinner table and doesn't flinch first. And here's the twist the system never accounts for. Kids don't break when they see the machinery. They wake up. That's the hope most people never get to hear. Because once your kid knows how they're being influenced, once they can spot the trick, name the mechanism, recognize the nudge, the spell cracks, the pressure doesn't vanish, but it loses its teeth for your child. Kids who know the game don't get played by it. Once they learn how propaganda dresses itself up as compassion, how conformity disguises itself as justice, and how shame masquerades as education, they stop swallowing it whole. They start asking, who benefits if I believe this? And that one question is enough to derail an entire indoctrination pipeline. Your kid doesn't need armor. They need clarity. They don't need you to scream about politics. They need you to show them what truth feels like. The calm, steady kind that doesn't buckle under pressure or vanish when a professor gives them a look. You can teach that at a kitchen counter. You can teach it in the car ride to campus. You can teach it kneeling next to a backpack the night before move-in, telling them, you don't have to agree with anyone to be brave. You don't have to fight everyone to be free. Just stay awake and just stay you. Parents forget the simplest power they have. Your voice, our voice, is the first narrative your kid ever heard. It lives deeper than any syllabus. It sits under every identity they'll try on. It's the compass they'll check when the room gets weird and they don't know which direction is true anymore. And if you teach them early, not what to think, but how to recognize the smell of bullshit, they will walk through that campus like a lighthouse in a fog bank. Not angry, not scared, just awake. And the system? It has no defense for an awake kid. No rubric for independent thought. No box for someone who refuses to play the role assigned to them. That's the future no one talks about. A generation that sees the strings and cuts them. A generation that can sit in any classroom, hear any ideology, and walk out with their spine intact. And that future doesn't start in a university boardroom. It starts at home with an honest conversation. You're about to walk into a machine, but you're not a cog, you're mine, and you know how to think. If you can give your kid that, clarity over fear, curiosity over conformity, then they're gonna be just fine. In fact, more than fine. They're going to change the world the right way, not by burning it down out of guilt, but by rebuilding it out of truth. All right, folks, here we are, the end of the maze. And if you stuck with me through all of this, then you already know something the machine hopes you never figure out. Awake parents raise awake kids. And awake kids are the one thing this whole structure can't predict, they can't mold, and absolutely cannot control. So thank you for watching this one with your eyes open and your heart in it. I don't take that lightly at all. If this one hit you the way it hit me, if it made you rethink a few things about college, about your kid, about yourself, then you're one of us now. Thank you, truly. I'm Ralph, and this is Divergent Files. Until next time, stay curious, stay grounded, and remember, no matter what they tell you, the truth is still out there.